Hello and welcome to episode 16 of Topical Fever. My name is David Parsons and we have a wonderful, lovely show for you today. This week my guest is Carlos Giraldo. Carlos is an English professor and a listener to Topical Fever. And someone who contacted my wife Claudia about coming on the show to talk about and respond to some of the things that we've talked about here on the podcast. Things like gentrification in New York City, the war on drugs, and a lot of other topics. So Carlos and Claudia and I sat down the other evening and had a great talk. Carlos shared a lot of stuff about growing up in New York in the 1970s and 1980s. He is coming from Washington Heights when he was a child, and he has lots of cool stories about Washington Heights in the 70s, stories that actually surprised me, especially considering that I lived in Washington Heights during the mid-2000s, I suppose, when I first came to New York City. Washington Heights was the first neighborhood that I lived in, and by the time I got there, it was a very, very different neighborhood than the one that Carlos describes. And so that it was great hearing his memories of that and kind of identifying things in my own memories that link up to that kind of history. We talked about the war on drugs, and it's another thing that kind of reminded me of my own childhood and gave me a different perspective on it, because when I was growing up in Ventura, California, I think I've probably mentioned this a few times on the show, being from a smaller, somewhat suburban, somewhat surfy Southern California town, we had a drug program in the 1980s called DARE. Obviously, this was a national program, part of Ronald Reagan's anti-drug efforts. And DARE, Drug Abuse Resistance Education, was, the face of it for us was in the fifth grade, which I'm thinking I must have been 9 or 10 years old. We have, a couple of cops show up in uniform to show us the cop car and then tell us not to do drugs. And that whole, just say no, this is your brain on drugs with the frying egg, all that kind of stuff that Justin and I talked about a few weeks ago in the War on Drugs episode, that propaganda campaign was a big part of my childhood, but really as a propaganda campaign. In other words, I wasn't living in a world in which drugs were being offered to me all the time, or even that people around me were being destroyed by them. I'm sure they were to some extent, but my point is that Carlos was coming from Washington Heights and responded to those Just Say No ads in a very different way, because the community around him. There was, a lot of visual evidence of the toll that drugs were taking in people's lives, not only physically destroying them, but getting them involved with the police and the prison system. So drugs played a very different kind of role in the lives of people that lived in these ravaged communities in New York City and other places in the 1980s. Certainly different than for me as a kid in Ventura. Listening to these cops talk about drugs sounded very foreign to me. I didn't really. It wasn't a world that I seemed to live in or seemed to understand. And I think there's something to explore there. So Carlos and Claudia and I had a really great conversation. And this is great evidence of the fact that if you're listening to this show, and you have issues that you want to respond to, I would love to sit down and have a conversation with you. So my email, my Twitter, my Facebook is all available on the blog. And I am contactable and open to sitting down with all range of folks. I would love to talk to you. So I hope you enjoy this conversation between Carlos Giraldo, Claudia, and me. One of the reasons that I am excited about talking to you, Carlos, is because when I first came to New York City, Washington Heights was the place that I landed. And I didn't even know Washington Heights existed when I first came here.
A lot of people don't, yeah.
Did you feel that way when growing up in Washington Heights, that you were in a forgotten neighborhood of New York City?
Yeah, because like most maps, they were cut off at 96th Street or 125th Street.
Yep.
And sometimes when crime happened in my neighborhood, which it often happened in the 80s, and it was in the news. It was supposedly in the Bronx that it happened.
Oh,
right.
No.
Right. Yeah.
The Bronx.
Yeah.
Right.
I think even funny. New Yorkers themselves don't know Washington Heights.
Yeah, that's true.
I remember saying that I lived in Washington Heights to people at the CUNY Graduate Center when I first started there, and there were people that lived in New York, and they said, is that the Bronx?
Is that the Bronx?
Yeah, for those that are listening that maybe are New Yorkers and don't know, or aren't New Yorkers and don't know, Washington Heights is at the top of Manhattan.
Yeah, it's above 125th Street on the west side.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as you go up in Manhattan, then east and west don't matter anymore.
Right.
Manhattan becomes so narrow.
Yeah.
Right.
But 125th Street, yeah.
So my impression, you know, I teach American history, so I'm always trying to, my impression is always trying to flatten things out, right? I want to like the big broad trends. And sure. If I was trying to describe the big broad trends in the 70s, and maybe you can correct the distortion that happens here, but if I was trying to say what was happening in the 70s in Washington Heights, I would probably say this was a time, a bad time. This is a time economically depressed in the 1970s. Is that wrong? Is that too much of a generalization?
Yeah, not exactly how I remember it. It was a time of transition.
Mm.
Washington Heights was predominantly a Jewish and Irish neighborhood, which was one of my beef with the Gatsby movie. That party that takes place...
the new Gatsby movie? The new Gatsby movie?
Yeah, the party that takes place in Washington Heights. Mm-hmm. It's depicted as if it was Harlem.
And it
wasn't at that time. It was very, very much Irish and Jewish, even to the 1970s.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, and there were a lot more white people around when I was little,
yeah.
Even though I didn't realize that at the time necessarily. But looking back, I realized there was a lot more white people when I was little than in the 80s or 90s in my area of Washington Heights. So
there's still that valley. Do you remember walking through that valley?
The steps.
Claudia's here with us. That's it. We hear her voice. You go down these steps from Fort Washington.
Yeah.
And you go down the steps, and then you kind of go through this valley, and then you go through a tunnel.
The subway tunnel.
Right. We go through this long, horrific-looking tunnel to get to the other side
on
of
the
Autobahn. Yeah. Yeah. And that's,
yeah.
Well, this
from
was
the
actually,
A side to the one.
Yeah. To the one train. Mm-hmm. And in that valley was mostly predominantly Jewish. And still is.
Yeah.
And so I suppose that's a remnant of that old demographic you're talking about.
Yeah, the Fort Washington area.
Mm-hmm.
Fort Washington and West.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so it was not as bad as it got in the 80s.
Yeah.
It was getting bad.
Okay, so the 80s was the time that we associate that I have in my head as the time with a lot of graffiti and a lot of garbage on the streets and to put that in context. What was happening in New York City was what was happening in a lot of cities, which was a bankruptcy of city infrastructure, and the result was a lack of services.
Right.
And so you see, and of course, as we've talked about in other episodes of this show, when that austerity happens and those lack of services happen, the places that are the most vulnerable are going to feel it the most. And so you're going to see that in neighborhoods like Washington Heights, who are already kind of teetering on the brink of some sort of poverty, decline even further into that.
Yeah.
And the sanitation doesn't come to collect.
Yeah.
And
literally,
then,
yeah.
Literally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like you're talking about trash cans
overflowing,
right? Yeah. And it's not just because people there consume more trash or are dirtier. It's because no one's coming to pick up their trash.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, there's great photo collections of the. And it's like weird to say a great photo collection of the horrific time in New York City, but of just kind of all the things that you would see. And one of the things that was very striking to me, I show my students every semester when I'm trying to describe this era in New York City, is it's a picture of the Manhattan Bridge, and the pedestrian walkway has like a chunk taken out of it, so you can see the water below, and there's like no cones around or anything. You literally just have to like step over, and it's like this insanely dangerous, like anyone could just fall into the river. And it's like this feeling of like abandonment. Is that something that
it was anarchic? I thought.
Yeah,
it was really anarchic. There was a lot of things that were bad, crime, but there was also a lot of creativity, and there was an innocence to that crime because I remember the 1970s with gangs. We had gangs like the Playboys and the Ballbusters.
Yeah,
and they would fight with knives and sticks. And
this
it was
in your neighborhood.
Innocent, yeah.
Yeah, it makes me think of The Warriors, which is a show, which is a movie I show in class sometimes just to give an impression of not like that there were actual baseball mime gangs running around, but that there was a social aspect to this.
They had the jackets. A lot of times.
Were you any of those social clubs?
No, not in any of those social clubs. No, I was always in the fringes, but I knew people that were in them.
How did you relate to that reality?
I'm not sure. I was always like friends with people who were.
It wasn't something that was scary to you. It was just kind of what reality was.
No, yeah, it was bothersome. At worst, it wasn't really scary. It did turn scary in the 80s when a lot of those kids. This was elementary school.
Yeah.
And then in the 80s, with the crack epidemic, a lot of these kids, you know, as teenagers and young adults, started to die.
With
the drug wars.
Right.
So that's why I think of it as more innocent.
Right.
Even though it was filthy, it was dirty.
Yeah.
There were services, as Claudio says, you know, you would see the streets filled with garbage, but there was an innocence to all that that compared to the 80s, to the 80s, there was an innocence.
So now we have this, you know, we talk about class inequality so much in terms of New York City, and obviously that was an era in which that was discussed too, but as a kid, was that something that you were aware of consciously at all, or was this kind of like, did you know you lived in a neighborhood that was different than other neighborhoods in New York,
That's
or was this kind
question.
Of like, I live in New York and we're all... Cause I say that because there's this kind of weird, like... democratic romanticization about New York City, that everybody's on the street no matter what, and we're all kind of no matter, we all come from different neighborhoods and different classes, we all ride the subway together. But I feel like there must be some kind of consciousness about it.
No, going below 125th Street, going to Midtown, was going to like a different world. And I think my first awareness of being different and being, I guess, poorer, being a minority, I was taking a bus ride with my mother, and I saw this very, I was like 7 or 8, and I saw this very cute blonde white girl as well, and I don't know why, I was looking at her, and it suddenly hit me that there was a difference between us. And so she was, I think she lived in downtown. She looked like she lived downtown. She was dressed very nicely for the times. And so that's when it first hit me that...
It's actually in The Warriors. I don't know how recently you've seen that movie, but there's a great scene in The Warriors on the subway I guess it's some of the Warriors are sitting there, right? And they're it's kind of late at night, and they're obviously like they're like punk kids, you know, and they're dressed like the way they dress, and and then like these like Upper West Side, I'm guessing, like kind of like middle class or upper middle class white kids get on there like dressed for prom. And they've got like their corsages and everything like that.
The fancy dresses.
And they sit down across from them. Yeah. And there's what's beautiful about this scene, and what's great about it to get students to write about it, is it's dialogue-less. They don't say anything.
That's true.
But they look at each other from across the subway, and they kind of have this understanding between all of them that we're all from different worlds. Yes. And at the next stop, the prom kids get up because they're uncomfortable and they leave.
Well, it's interesting, Carlos, that you said about the subway, because I think that's probably the first place, like the public transportation, that I would have thought about difference as well, because I grew up in a, and I've said this on the show before, but a kind of like quasi-suburban part of Brooklyn. But because my parents were all about hanging out in Manhattan, I understood the subways are the one place that I, the quote unquote, felt dangerous. That it was my mom took the subway every day to work, and then we would take the subway, and it was always a source of strain and like tension. And then
why did it feel dangerous to you?
Because my parents said that it was right, and so I, because I mean I'm
but I mean it was also formed by your own impression of it. It wasn't just your parents telling you, right?
I
mean,
that's interesting. I think that I probably absorbed what my parents said as like, this is somehow unsavory in some way, that there's a possibility for crime in the public transportation that there isn't at home, that then I translated into standing in the subways, which were really, really loud at the time. We used to take the 2 train, the old Redbirds, and my God, they were loud. You know what I mean?
Is this screeched. The graffiti era of the
this
trains?
This is probably just past it, or...
It's because, I mean, that's just the icon, right, of that era, is that there was graffiti all
there's
over the train.
There's definitely graffiti. Yeah, there's definitely
somehow
graffiti.
Made the, for those that don't know this or live in New York City, at some point in the 1980s, they invented a magical train that cannot be painted for some reason. And And you really...
you have Koch to thank for that.
Yeah, the subway has been... that each car has been treated with some sort of like lacquer that you can't spray paint on.
Yeah.
And, when I was in... I think it was Paris that the subway stations still look that way. The subways still are covered in graffiti.
Really?
And it's like, it's really cool. Yeah. If you're in Paris, it's like being in 1980s or 70s New York City. Because you're like, whoa, there's... And for me, it was cool because I actually felt like, oh, I could see a spirit of people on that graffiti. Yeah. But I know most people do not feel that way. They feel like they associate it with crime and danger and drugs.
I had a different relation to the subway because I used to make my mother take subway rides for no reason.
Really?
On weekends, and we didn't have any plans or nowhere to go. I would like
it's like riding a roller coaster.
Keep complaining, yeah, because they were loud and they were also very bumpy.
Yes.
So they were fun. Yeah,
they were fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were fun. I used to love to get on trains.
Yeah,
they were dirty, of course. They were full of graffiti, but I used to love them. Yeah.
But I think that's great because I think if my parents hadn't sort of imparted this idea, they would have been way more exciting to me. You know, whereas I was sort of understood that because my mom took the train every day back and forth to work and then the bus because of where we lived, that there was just this sort of like, will she make it home every day? Right. Because my mom,
will she even survive?
Will she? Right. Right. Yeah. And it's sort of like looking at it now, it seems silly. But when I was 6, 5, and 7, this was a real source of like, I would look out the window waiting for the bus to come. And my mom worked up at Columbia University. She worked at the hospital right next to Columbia University, St. Luke's Roosevelt. Uh-huh. So it was 113th Street, 117th Street.
Yeah.
And so I knew that she was going far on the 2, right, on the IRT. And so that she was going through, quote unquote, bad neighborhoods, which in retrospect, I understand to be very different than I think I was taught when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But that the subway and the public transportation and the buses are where you sort of... because you talked about open space, right? Yeah. And like where everyone's on the street and you all see each other. That's where you see it the most because in our neighborhood, you didn't.
There's also something about... I like that idea of the parents creating the fear in a weird way, too. I know that because growing up near Los Angeles, but not in Los Angeles,
right.
L.A., my parents set up L.A. to me as a place that you're lucky to survive if you go down there. And I grew up during the time... Well, L.A. was pretty bad, too, in the 1980s, and then the L.A. riots happened, and it was kind
That's
of considered 93, like...
right, or 92.
92, you know, I was young enough when the L.A. riots happened, I was, you know, 13 or 14, 13 years old when L.A. riots happened, that you know, to hear the kind of way it's perceived in the suburbs by white suburban people is that, oh, they are dragging white people out of cars and killing them down in Los Angeles.
Reginald Denny?
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Thank you. Yeah. Reginald Denny was like our martyr, you know, very much so. And it was like, we're wearing shirts in the suburbs that say like, we are all Reginald Denny. But you know who Reginald Denny is?
Of course, yeah.
Okay. So, he's fine. He's somewhere. I read about him on Wikipedia somewhere. But either way, the idea that the city is a place of demonic energy and a place where you're lucky to survive. And even like if you step out of the car in those neighborhoods, you'll just get shot automatically.
Well, yeah. And you know, because you mentioned graffiti and you're talking about the 80s and that vision of graffiti that in our little sort of quasi-suburban part, the closest we got to that was I don't know where everyone got the refrigerator boxes from to breakdance, you know?
Yeah. Oh,
and that was
yeah.
the kind of like, that was as out there as we got in our little neighborhood, and it was a big tragedy.
We did that too. I never get bigger laughs from my students than when I tell them that we laid down that me and my wife me and my white brothers laid down the cardboard on the front lawn in Back to the Future Land. And played Run DMC
on a radio
that we called it Ghetto Blaster. And I did not even know what Ghetto Blaster. I mean, that term was just like from, it might as well have been, a Transformer. You know what I mean? Like,
he had no idea.
Ghetto Blaster was just the name. I didn't get that it was something that was from some place called a ghetto, which is a place in an urban area. I mean, I really didn't. It was just kind of like, well, this is what's hot. And now I know that what was happening is like record companies were saying, like, look, people are going to love this. And shoving it in our face. Of course I was listening to it.
Right.
But.
Well, that's the thing. And so, you had talked earlier about, or at some point, about the complexity of New York, right? And, you know, you asked Carlos about feeling like you were someplace else in Washington Heights or, you know,
right?
And so it's like, as a kid, it's interesting because you don't have a conception of I don't know, that larger thing you only outside, understand, yeah. right? So you're...
Only in hindsight do I realize.
Yes, exactly. The context.
How far out I was of mainstream America.
Me too. I had no idea. I had no idea, that like how it was, how it was pictured and what our city was. I mean, I sure remember who Reagan, because he was the president when I was a kid, but had no clue what that really meant.
And that brings up something that we were talking about before we pressed record here is the lunches you were talking about, Carlos.
Yeah, in the late 70s, I remember lunches in the summers, we would go to this park at around 161st Street. In the west side, there was a little park by a hill, and there would be a truck that would stop by around 12 o'clock with lunches. They had the cardboard lunch tray and the milk cartons.
Oh, wow. God.
And this was in the summer. We were not in summer schools, but they would give free lunches to all elementary school kids, at least. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I remember doing that for a couple of summers, and then suddenly one summer they were gone. They were no longer there. It's like, what happened? And
now looking
back, Ronald Reagan happened, 1981. That's when it stopped. We stopped getting the free lunches. So.
Yeah, and it makes me realize how much. And something I guess I thought about a little bit when in the suburbs, but not as much as I thought about it in New York, is how much the public school system is vital to keeping things going, and helping families get through very shitty economic situation. Yeah.
But that was endemic of what happened in the 80s in New York and neighborhoods like Washington Heights, where you felt that there was a withdrawal from the government. And I was a kid, so I couldn't really express it then. But looking back, I felt that there was somebody that cared about us beyond our own immediate circle. There was somebody else looking out for us, and then suddenly that was withdrawn.
But what about do you remember the Say No to Drugs campaign and Just Say No and all that? There's a, see,
that one I could be surprisingly conservative.
They care about you there.
Well, I could be surprisingly conservative about that because you do have to say no. I never did any substances until after I graduated from college.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was constantly offered them. Like, I couldn't walk two blocks without having somebody offer me,
is that true, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Literally, yeah.
Is that a product of Washington Heights?
That was a product of Washington Heights,
right,
yeah. Oh,
right.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I was never offered drugs until high school, late high school. And I mean, it was it was not crack cocaine on the street from a dealer or something like that. It was pot from kind hippies.
I totally understand what you're saying, Carlos, because that's there is a very different perspective on drug use in terms of where you're coming from. Because if you're coming,
drugs didn't ravage the community where I come from.
And that makes a difference in how you think about it. And I mean, that's a really complex problem, but that's interesting because
I was clean and sober until I became middle class. Then things started going downhill.
That's great.
I have this story. This was late 80s, so 1988-89. Graduated from high school in 89. And I went to college at Boston College, but I went for a day of just looking at the campus, right?
Right.
Most kids went with their parents, suburban car ride. I took an Amtrak at 3 o'clock in the morning. So at 2 o'clock in the morning, I don't know how my mother let me do this because she was very protective. I was 17. I took the subway, the one train from 157th to Penn Station. And by the way, Penn Station's in the 80s was a mess.
Right.
But even before I got there, there was this guy who was... There have been some gunshots earlier that day, and this guy was sitting next to me in the train waiting for the one to come. So around 2 o'clock in the morning, so it was very sporadic. And he was asking me questions about hey, dude, little guy, did you hear those shots? And he was trying to suss out if I knew anything. It was no. And then he said, oh, you're cool. Then sitting down on the benches with me, took out a bag, took out his license, and started doing cocaine.
There you go.
He asked me, he's like, I don't know if I should ask you because you seem clean, but if you want some, I'll give you some. And I was like, no.
Wow.
And that was my road to college.
Literally,
road to college. So I was like, okay.
I guess, you know what? That's interesting because that actually all of a sudden makes my parents caution about taking the 2 train, the 1 train, the 3 train from Brooklyn up to 125th. Make a little more sense because
riding that train high on cocaine.
Hey now.
It was. Yes.
And obviously my parents would have seen a lot more than I would have because I went with them to you know, we would go for Saturday afternoons or for dinners, and it was at quote unquote reasonable times. I was never on the train at 1 or 2 in the morning, whereas I know that my dad was.
Yeah,
right?
And he has a great story. Your dad, your dad tells this story. I've heard this story a few times from your dad.
Is it the umbrella story?
No, it's like Claudia's father. I'm not sure what the umbrella.
I'll tell you the umbrella story.
Maybe this is it. But Claudia's father quit riding the train at a certain point, and I think partially because of these experiences in the 80s. Of like this late night kind of
thing. It was also a class thing. He finally got a car and was said, I don't have to ride the trains anymore.
You've graduated.
It was reasonable. Yeah.
You
moved on.
Oh, and that's definitely something about New York that I've learned is that you can graduate off the train at a certain point.
It's hard,
in your
though.
Life. But it is hard. And some people actually do prefer the train. Yeah. But either way, Claudia's dad tells this story about being kind of basically scared of people on the train late at night and kind of regularly acting crazy. Yes. And like kind of wanted whenever he would be on the train, he would act like he was a little nuts.
Oh, really?
So that he would intimidate people, and people would think, oh, that guy's crazy.
This is the umbrella story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the umbrella story is, you know how you you pop open the umbrellas with the button? Right, I'm sorry. If you can't see me, but I'm making them, I'm doing it. I'm popping open the umbrella.
Everybody understands.
So he tells a story of there was, you know, somebody on the train who was clearly crazy or acting crazy, and my dad, in defense, acted like he was crazier, right?
Yes.
And so he started doing that where he was jabbing the umbrella and opening it and closing it, and the guy just sort of, that he was trying to defend himself against, you know, kind of backed away.
Yeah.
And it's the same story of, I think that, I mean, I feel like even now you see the entire city, right? Obviously on the one subway car, and then there's levels of insanity that we all inhabit on the subway.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, that question of, you know, I feel like my parents saw things on the subway that I certainly didn't as a kid, and I don't know that I have now necessarily.
That's
right?
A good strategy, though. Fight crazy with crazier.
Right, yeah. Fight crazy with crazier. Exactly. It worked.
But do you have any stories like that? You must have some kind of stories.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I feel like, okay, so when I started taking the subways by myself from Brooklyn into Manhattan, which in itself was considered crazy in the suburban neighborhood I grew up in, and I mean, I've said this before, but there I grew up with kids who weren't allowed on the subways, which... just, you know, they weren't
that's
allowed.
Interesting to me.
Right,
that's
exactly. That's exactly. Yeah. They were not allowed, and so we were the weirdos, and I went on my own. But I started doing that in the 90s, and that was a real, I don't know, there was a sort of really good feeling about New York.
Yeah,
at least
stories about getting on the train by yourself and going to the Village as like this for this
16,
is an adventure.
17,
and this
15,
actually,
yeah.
And you've described, and this is something I didn't understand either, is that you've described that as making you unique in your neighborhood. As,
yes.
I remember seeing something about Claudia Goes to the City, you know, that other high school kids knew about you, is that you go to the city.
The city.
So you were brave and dangerous.
I was brave and dangerous. Oh yeah, no! It marked me as a total
weirdo.
How
about you, Carlos? Did you go down to? I mean, because you're. When I was in Washington Heights, when I lived up there, I was like, yes, I'm in Manhattan technically.
Yeah.
But I felt you might as well be in Brooklyn because it's a long subway ride up there through through a lot of territory that is not like Manhattan.
Yeah.
And you get up there and you feel like, I don't know, I felt like I was in a different borough entirely.
We, as teenagers, my friends and I would hang out a lot in the Village as well, but it was a different kind of dynamic. We were seen as sort of trying to be snobbish or, you know, trying to be too good for the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Because most people would... their idea of going out was hanging out at a different corner.
Yeah. That's great.
Like, not 161st, but go to 163rd.
Yeah. 163rd and Broadway. That corner is where it's at.
Yeah, that's what's going on
now.
It's
a different bodega.
Yeah.
Oh, I totally can understand that. Yeah, that you're seen. And I think that I face the same thing from a different angle of like the, oh, she's too cool for us.
Yeah.
And I didn't, well, at 15, I probably did think that, but I wasn't. It was just.
It was true.
It was true.
It was true. Because guess what?
You're a huge cooler.
Snob. Yeah. For some reason, they got it into the head that I thought I was better than them.
That's because I was.
But when you're going down to the Village, what were you doing down there if you're teenagers? And we weren't going to bars, were you? Or what?
Sometimes we could order beers because nobody would card you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially in restaurants.
Yeah. So like the whole idea of pounding beers and going crazy, I didn't experience that till college.
Right.
You would in restaurants you could order a beer with get yeah. the burger and uh-huh. you're 16.
Uh-huh. Nobody would, most places would not ask yeah. you. Yeah.
Wow.
They wouldn't do anything. Yeah. So we would do that.
What
and
a degenerate
just,
city.
We would walk around, go to movies.
Uh-huh. Yep.
We could go to movies in Washington Heights, but why do
but
that?
But you weren't doing something so snobbish down there. It sounds like you were just being a teenager.
No. Yeah. Being teenager.
But it was just the person. That's what's amazing about it to me is that yeah. you weren't going down there and like sipping cappuccino and no. going to MoMA. No. You know, you were like just fucking around like a teenager yeah. would.
We were just not doing house parties and
right.
know, right, right.
hanging out in the neighborhood.
So. Right, that which is the same exact thing that I was doing was yeah. not doing the parties in yeah. the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I was going out and that's what we did. We walked around the city, went to movies,
you know
walked
what,
on the East Village.
The, here in Sunset Park, I think the equivalent is both the we have the corner here, but we also have the we live in a neighborhood that's all brownstones, right? So it's like there's this and I've heard people talking about it, the like hanging out on the stoop. And we definitely have like some stoop dwellers on the street and around here that are just kind of like, that's what they do. That's their social life. It's kind of like hanging out in the stoop, yeah. watching people pass by.
Yep.
And that thing in Washington Heights about the bodegas and the different corners, I actually haven't seen this since Washington Heights, is in the summer, the dudes that hung out on the corners that were like older guys that drank, yeah. basically, they brought lawn chairs.
Yep.
They bring lawn chairs.
And they
yeah.
would just it'd be like the beach out there, and then they would hang out, and like it was kind of like a bar, because they would go in and buy, you know, a single tall boy, right? Or a single 40, or just a bottle of beer.
Yeah.
And even Lucy cigarettes, right? Mm-hmm. And treat it like a bar. And I always was kind of like, well, you make do with what you've got. This is what I kind of admired it. I was like, this is a low rent little bar yeah. that's going on here, and this is a social club.
I would like to point yeah. out that my grandma also, without the beer,
she was a corner dweller.
Well, this is a maybe a uniquely New York or urban dwelling sort of thing. But my grandma, who lived in an apartment a couple blocks away from our apartment, all the ladies in the neighborhood brought out lawn chairs and they sat outside of the building because it was hot in the apartment.
That's the air conditioning.
Thank yeah. you. And right.
If you're poor or before air
well,
conditioning.
Well, yeah, I definitely. Yeah. Everybody
and there
was
no drink involved.
In the summertime.
Yeah.
And this reminds me of Requiem for a Dream. That you've seen, have you seen Requiem for a Dream? It's like that.
Also, sans drugs and alcohol.
I've
my
never seen
bar.
It. There's just
yeah.
a scene.
Sheepshead Bay.
Where there's yeah. just women in Brooklyn, older women in Brooklyn, sitting outside with the foil thing, yeah. you know, reflecting into their face and yeah. like tanning themselves and like I mean there is a human need for the sun,
yeah,
you know. Coming from California, Southern California, this the outdoor life,
I think
the
you
outdoor
take it
life
for granted
is very yeah that you take it yeah. for granted, but here people find it, they want it, and they want to be outside, and you know, if it's a lawn chair outside of a liquor store, yeah. that's what you
or the lawn chair outside of the apartment building, which was for my grandma.
Yeah. The summer of 93, after I graduated from college and I moved back to New York always dragged me back, and I ended up in Washington Heights. Actually, no, I ended up in Inwood, which was a move up.
But
that's even further up.
Yeah, but it's nicer, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, like 207th Street.
Yeah, 207. That's yeah. where I live. 207 uh-huh. in Ashram.
Yeah. Right.
But I would still go to Washington Heights to visit friends and stuff, and I would see drug dealers pumping iron. Literally, they had benches and they were pumping iron in the streets.
Muscle Beach.
Yeah, that's yeah. when I have to confess something. That this might excommunicate me from mm-hmm. the leftist brotherhood at CUNY. But
uh-oh.
Oh no,
that's what made me vote for Giuliani. I was like, okay, I had enough of this.
Yeah.
You know, bring on Giuliani.
The crack dealers pumping iron.
Well, that's
yeah.
a real, that's a really interesting political paradox about yeah. New York City yeah. and this era. And I think it's one that hasn't been solved, and the left and the right can't really. Explain which we can't really come to terms with, which is that New York got safer yeah. In the years since. A lot of that is credited to Giuliani and his administration's tough on crime policies.
Yeah.
And we've reached a situation in New York where crime is at a rate that's exponentially lower than it used to be. We're talking about 900, 1,200, 1,500 murders
yeah.
a year,
yeah.
down to like 300 now.
Yeah.
So that's great. But yet we have an NYPD yeah. and a system of laws that are monstrously unfair. And that's a paradox. I mean, this is something that we can't really get through, I think. We're at a block right now.
True.
As we try and come to terms with that.
Well, I remember, I think it cracked 2000. Like the yeah. year before he got elected.
2,000 murders?
Yeah.
Yeah.
2,000 murders.
It's unbelievable numbers.
Yeah. You have to give him some credit. He was like a police commissioner. He was right. the mayor's right. police commissioner.
Right.
So you have to give that some credit.
I think you can also just say that when you break out a hammer, the hammer is going to have an effect.
It's going to have an effect.
You know what I mean? And it's like the hammer is going to be ugly, but it's going to have an effect.
I do believe the argument that there were internal reasons in a lot of these neighborhoods why it happened. People grew up seeing this violence, this crime, and so the next generation probably
was really determined to do whatever it took. And that leads to a kind of conservatism.
People don't want to follow in the footsteps of the older brother who got killed.
Totally makes sense.
And my vision of just even riding the subways is so different, and it's such a I guess a relief in the considering of like being a kid. I mean, it's amped up as a kid where, you know, you're sort of like, is my mother going to come home every day? Because that's just like a thing that kids have anyway. Right. But like I don't know, once I started, you know, when I started riding the subways on my own in the 90s and I didn't think about Giuliani or Mayor Dinkins or whatever was happening, I was just thinking, oh, well, sure, it's totally normal and fine. And I'm not worried about crime.
So you didn't think like, oh, it's safer now. And thank God this specific policy led to it.
Oh, totally not.
And you didn't think of it as being like cops.
No, not at that time. But the NYPD was also not, at least not in the neighborhoods that I traveled to East Village and from where
nearly
I came
what
from.
They are now.
Not visible in the same way. Yeah. And I think that, I don't know, I think there's been an evolution, right? And Carlos, what you're saying is like the sort of like really positive thing in certain neighborhoods changing and people feeling like, oh, I'm going to make it through adulthood. Whereas like, you know, you're seeing beforehand shit just happening in front of you. Right. Yeah. Whereas now I think it's evolved. It's reached a different sort of turned a different sort of corner now. And now we're in a kind of different position.
The economy got better in the 1990s.
Yeah.
Too.
Right. That's true. So,
Giuliani got to benefit from a little bit of that.
Too. Oh, absolutely.
I wouldn't say a little bit of that, a lot of that.
Yeah.
That there was not in the sense that poverty was eradicated, but in the sense that there was a boom economically, and that like a rising tide, you know, all ships go up. I didn't get that right, but you know what I mean. there was a general social and economic lifting during this time. And you know, it should be said that Chicago right now is experiencing crime that's like nearly comparable to 80s New York.
Yes, it is.
And they have really abrasive policies towards crime, just like Giuliani did.
And it's not having the same effect.
And economic issues are obviously a big part of that.
Right.
So
it's all
tied together. It's weird.
Well, the population has to be ready for the change. Yeah, you can't just say, oh, we're going to drop the cops on the neighborhood. And that's going to fix things.
Yes.
You know? And I remember there was a riot in Washington Heights in 93, in the summer of 93.
Really?
I think this was before
Were you there? How long were you there? When did you finally leave Washington Heights? Well, you went to Boston College. So
in that summer, I was still at Boston. I hadn't come back yet.
Uh-huh.
But there was a riot because I guess this kid who was a suspected drug dealer was died while he was running for the cops. And people in the neighborhood said the cops had killed him.
Mm-hmm.
And the cops were saying that he jumped sort of out the window trying to jump a ledge,
I guess.
He fell to his death. So there was, when the population felt pressure, there was a backlash too.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's really, I didn't understand that when the LA riots happened. And I think a lot of people still don't understand that when the LA riots happened, it was like over Rodney King, right?
Right.
And it was like, Rodney King got beat up. And I was like, really? All these people are just mad about Rodney
King? No. It's
like, not
much,
really.
Yeah.
It was like Rodney King was just like visible proof of what had been going on a lot. And
right.
It wasn't even that all black people had been beaten by the police. It was just the evidence of the just utter disrespect and the utter kind of feeling of like we're the victims of this system and we have no recourse and look at what's happening to us and this is, we can't take this anymore. Like Rodney King was just too brutal. It's actually a totally different subject. We'll bring it up later, but I did want to just mark this, is that the idea that we're videotaping police brutality all the time now.
Rodney King was
a big deal. And people
I
mean, they profiled the guy that videotaped this and like, oh, he's like, he had a video camera. He was a guy that like had a video camera.
Yeah.
But like everybody, if you go on YouTube right now and search police brutality, you're going to find just video after video, sickening video after sickening video. And it's crazy because there's not a riot coming out of all of that stuff.
Right,
it's
and like that's what I mean, though, is like...
different level of visibility.
Turning the corner of we're in a very different place of, like, you know, when Giuliani comes in and he, there's a confluence of circumstances that are happening that change the city, right? Whereas you say, like, you know, in Chicago right now, they're trying similar tactics and it's not working, right? Because the circumstances are not all the same, and we're in some other kind of place now of like seeing things. And if you
there's
take,
a limit to those policies,
right? That's the thing is, if you take those policies,
I think the policies
yeah.
work, but there's a limit to them too. Right, like you're right. saying, Carlos, the population has to be ready for it. Yeah. If it's just a population, if the cops are just going to come and lay on top of a population that's already experiencing so much social trauma, then you're not really going to get anywhere.
No, you get yeah. riots, you get a
yeah, right. Yeah, you get a guy being thrown out a window in Washington right. Heights, and the neighborhood reacting not because they really cared about that guy, but because they feel like I'm that guy too. Yeah, like everybody, exactly. right, like right. the cops would throw me out a window if they had a chance.
Exactly. Yeah. Totally. Mm-hmm. Totally. Wait. So when did you leave Washington Heights for good?
Yeah. To go back to that question. Mm-hmm. Well, I was born there in 1971. I left it for good to answer the question directly in 2005.
Oh, so recently. Well, recently-ish.
Yeah, recently-ish. Yeah. But I kept leaving and coming back. It would drag me back.
2005
does sound
recent.
That's how I feel about
recent.
New York. Yep. He's yeah. dragging me back.
Yeah. The first time I left, I went to the Dominican Republic, which is like, it was a cultural practice. I don't know if it's still going on with immigrants. They send their kids, their native, well, their American-born kids, they send them back to the country so that they can be safer. I don't know if they need to do that anymore in New York. But
what do you mean so they can be safer?
So they, I remember when I graduated from elementary school, I wanted to go, but my mother was worried that going to junior high school, all the junior high schools were bad. And
okay, let me just interrupt. Junior high school in New York is considered notoriously, it's the scariest, unsafest, most dangerous part of the way through.
I think that's true. I think that's true. And that was true even across the country.
Okay.
I mean, if anybody's seen the movie Welcome to Dollhouse,
yeah.
captures the idea of middle school
as the worst time.
It's the cauldron in which your identity is forged. If I'm ever in a situation to like punch a wall or get like so pissed that I like hurt myself,
it's the
like 12
year
old. Something, it's because of whatever happened in middle school, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
No. So I was sent to the Dominican Republic, and I guess because of the dollar conversion or whatever, they could afford to send me to a private Catholic school, and that was my first sort of introduction to middle class suburban lifestyle
in the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, that prepared me for Boston College, where I went to school. And like, if I survived funny. Boston College was because I was familiar with the Dominican Republic, and I went to a school called La Salle down there, and it was really middle class and upper middle class. Some people got driven to school by their chauffeurs.
Wow.
And so I was like, wow. Yeah,
I think that might be the first time I've ever heard the idea that the Dominican Republic prepared me for Boston.
The Dominican prepared me for Boston.
So what, when you went to Boston, was that a culture shock to go to Boston from New York City?
It still because was. Like, yeah, it was a big culture shock.
I mean, to a lot of Americans that aren't from the Northeast might think, well, Boston, New York, it's pretty much the same thing, right?
No, it's a different world. It's smaller city. It's in some way architecturally it's more beautiful than New York. Mm-hmm. It's just more coherent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's also very provincial, I think. Mm-hmm. It's, if you're an outsider, especially if you're a darker skinned outsider,
yes.
it's not very welcoming.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I had some interesting experiences
yeah.
going out and socializing in Boston. Yeah.
I can imagine. That's exactly the idea I get of Boston, is that provinciality is kind of like, well, you're from Boston and you're not from Boston, and like, but in New York, you don't feel, I don't feel that as much. As much as like Claudia, I think of as such a New Yorker.
She's welcoming.
Yeah, she has been very welcoming to me,
despite the fact that I'm from Brooklyn. Yeah.
But even the provincial aspects of Claudia, who talks about New York in a very specific way, and mm-hmm. I think you're very defensive about New York mm-hmm. in a lot of different ways.
I come
ways.
From a very provincial part of Brooklyn.
But not like Boston. I feel like Boston's almost like a gang. You know what I mean? Like in Boston, you're like...
The gangs of Boston.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it closes very early, too, which is... New York stands out to me because it's like the only really international city I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And Boston, my memory, it closes at 11 o'clock. Mm, and it's like, mm-hmm. really, what's going on here?
Yeah.
See, that's interesting, right? Because I did not understand that other cities are not functioning 24 hours a day. And the fact that other cities' subways close down blows my mind, because that really actually makes me nervous, because, I mean, how do you get home? Yeah, what do you do? You
know, and then that happened to me. That happened to me when I in Rome. It's funny. I've only taken like two very short trips to Europe, but I feel like on this show I've brought up Europe so many times. People have the idea that I'm like that I'm like constantly going over to Europe. But in my,
I've been there twice.
In my limited experience in Europe, I mean, in Rome, I remember going out for a night. And I was out by myself, and I went out somewhere on the train, and I'd mapped it out. I went to dinner, and I did whatever I was doing, and at the end of the night, I was headed back, and I went to the train, and everything was closed, and I was like,
"What am I supposed to do now?"
I mean, it was shocking to me. And I was finally able to like talk to someone, like a cop or something. I don't remember who I talked to, but that just explained, yeah, the trains are closed. They closed it, and then like literally,
they closed at 11.
No, it's earlier. They were like closed at 9 or 9:30. Wow. They were like,
how are people supposed to get around?
And you know what? Huh? The train is for. You know what it is? It's the culture of it. Is the train is for work, and so it's like once work is done, everyone's where they're gonna be, and like that's that. I guess that's how it runs.
It brings up an interesting point because in cities like London. Yeah, you mentioned Paris and Rome. You kind of have to be in the know to stay up late, stay up at night.
How you're going to get around
in
after
New York City?
You don't have to.
A common person stay up all night.
Yes,
you know.
Yes, New York. That was what was attractive for me. I was just talking to my students about this yesterday because we were talking about this whole we're talking about urban America in our class right now, and we're talking about my outsider's perspective coming from a town much smaller. And it's not like I come from like an Andy Griffith small town. I come from a mid-sized American city. I mean, there's like 150,000 people there or something like that. Mm-hmm. But everything closes down very early. And
I can attest.
Yes.
It does.
And that really shrunk. I felt like because of the smallness of it, it shrunk the possibilities in my mind of what I could be. Like, it was literally like, oh, I can only be, there's only a few things I can imagine. I could only imagine a few futures for myself. Oh, but when I came to New York City, I knew that everything was open late and like that you could, I just felt like possibilities, like infinite possibilities, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's and it's, you know, like
there's a million narratives and stories that I might find myself in here, whereas in my town I come from I could only imagine like two stories,
right? But see, that's interesting.
They were
though
boring.
Because I think that even if you're from here, depending on class and gender and all these other things, right, that New York is not necessarily as filled with as many possibilities as, as it would have felt to you.
That's
coming
the romantic notion.
Right,
yes.
From Ventura, where it's like,
that's
my,
the Rick Burns documentary, right, of the immigrants on the boat being
right,
like, oh,
this is majesty. Like, wow.
It's like, yeah, it's majesty, but what, that majesty you see, you will never be in those buildings.
Right, but even like, you know, I don't know, like, right, exactly, like being a woman, being a, you know, a partial part Puerto Rican woman, being a poor-ish woman, that you know, a part of it came from my mom of like, this is what you are as a woman, this is what you're allowed to do, this is what you're not allowed to do, this is where, if you know, the sort of what's open to you in terms of class, like what is open to you, that I think, you know, we've talked about this before, but I had as romantic a vision of New York City as you did, David. You know what I mean? And because so much of it, I came from this.
No, I know you did.
Yeah,
I think we share that a little bit because
this provincial
Claudia
sort of
comes from a place that wasn't that wasn't Manhattan.
No,
it's actually quite far from Manhattan.
It's super. You've
it's
been
New York
there.
City,
you know how far, how long it takes us to get out to my parents' neighborhood where I grew up. Yeah, that it's that idea of provinciality. I think people are often surprise. And so here's another sort of thing, right? Like I, for years and years and years, people would say, where are you from? And they meant what neighborhood?
Yeah,
right. And then I graduated college and I worked at a bookstore. I worked at the Strand bookstore for a year before I went to graduate school. And people said, where are you from? And they didn't mean what neighborhood. They meant what city? Like, are you from?
So they thought
Salt
you were
Lake
not
City.
From-
huh. Well, the assumption, everyone at this, it blew my mind because people were from Columbus.
And
they were from
you,
Salt Lake City. They were from, and I'm like, oh, Marie.
Right,
I said, oh,
right.
Mill Basin. And they're like, what do you mean? What does that mean?
Didn't you feel the same thing at the CUNY Graduate Center?
Yes, but I had been primed for it. I was
what
ready
about,
for it.
What about Brooklyn College? Was it?
No, Brooklyn College, everyone,
all
it was
New
neighborhoods.
Yorkers.
It was neighborhoods.
Yeah.
It was like, are you from Kensington? Are you from Mill Basin? Mm. Are you from Marine Park?
Because Baruch is not that way. I mean,
no.
I asked yesterday, I said,
neither is LaGuardia,
how
right?
How many of you are from, or not from New York, and almost the entire class raised their hand. So, and a lot of that is international. But either way, I didn't get the feeling that I'm teaching New Yorkers in the same way that Brooklyn College.
No, I did not get that at all until after I had graduated college, that people that where you were from didn't mean your neighborhood.
When did you graduate college?
98.
Oh, so it must still be the case that Brooklyn is mostly New Yorkers?
Yes, definitely, because that neighborhood, because Brooklyn is, Brooklyn College is probably more international and just more diverse now, just because New York in general is. Yeah. But yeah, Brooklyn College is too deep in Brooklyn. It's not like Baruch, which is on 25th Street in Lexington Avenue in the middle of Manhattan.
Right, right.
Or LaGuardia, which is in the middle of where Carlos and I teach, which is in the middle of really diverse international Queens. True. So it's local Queens, but it's international Queens.
Baruch College is also a business school, so it's very much where you go if you're trying to be particular kind of capitalist.
Right.
Young immigrant up-and-coming capitalist.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But Brooklyn College
is... good name for a book.
Yeah,
I'm Brooklyn... a young immigrant capitalist.
Yeah. No, Brooklyn College is too deep Brooklyn. It's on the train line, at least. I mean, because my neighborhood was even further, where you took the 2 train to Flatbush Avenue and then you took the bus to get where you were going. Brooklyn College is at least at the end of the line, but it's still the end of the line. Flatbush is the first stop in Brooklyn on the 2-3-5 line, right? And it's very, it's local. Yeah, it's mostly local kids still.
Yeah. So, David, I'm just curious. Did you go through a period that where you were just partying all the time?
In New York? In New York
till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning every night?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that, that's what... I've mentioned this word before, and it's such a high theory thing, but like the Michel Foucault's idea of the heterotopia, which is the fantasy space. Yeah. I mean, that's what New York was for me when I first got here. Yeah. Yes, we'll do a topical fever podcast.
Actually, the heterotopia.
It's funny you bring that up, because I was thinking of the fact that that first summer that I was in New York was the summer of 2003, so it's exactly 10 years from right now. And we, my friends and I, very self-consciously and we thought we were so clever, referred to that as the summer of booze, because we drank so much because we had the opportunity to.
Yeah.
I mean, and part of that was in California, we were driving.
Right.
And we wanted to hang out in bars, but we also were scared of getting DUIs.
Yeah.
And so it was like hanging out in bars was just not something that we regularly did. And if we did, we were always anxious.
Okay.
But in New York, it was like, we can go to the Village. And we can spend all night just going bar to bar, or take the train back. And the friend that I was hanging out with at the time lived in the Village, so we just crashed at his place all the time. And yes, it was fantastic.
Yeah. I got to confess, as a native New Yorker, I guess that's my pet peeve with middle class immigrants into the city.
We were the hipster gentrifiers.
That was my pet peeve from my wife.
And like, yeah, bro, New York's awesome. I love New York.
Exactly.
Yeah. I just want to point out I've never heard David talk like that in my life.
Well, when I met
my wife, been there 10 years ago. That's all it was.
It's a good thing I didn't.
When I met my wife, and I cleared this up with her because I got her permission. But we would go out, and it was like, okay. The party's done at 3. He's like, oh no, I know of another party going on someplace else. I was like, no, I don't do this. I just go back 3 o'clock. That's late enough.
That's
I'm supposed to be in bed.
Yeah,
people come and they're the ones who really live that lifestyle.
Right.
Of like,
the outsiders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Painting the town red.
But even the outsiders, in terms of like, when I was there, it was like the term was like the B&Ters, the bridge and tunnel people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The resentment from the quote unquote real New Yorkers was for the New Jersey
people. Yep.
Yes. No,
my resentment is international.
Yes.
All middle class immigrants.
Yeah. Whatever. Yeah.
New Jersey.
Whereas mine was New Jersey.
Columbus, specifically. Ohio, whatever it is.
But I think some of that has to do with youth. Right, some of that has to do with like age.
Yeah. Totally.
Some of that, but you know, that kind of like romantic, let's find and just stay out as late as I possibly can, is some of that. And you know, Carlos, to some extent, you might understand this, right? Is that because you're coming from, I don't know, sort of the outer reaches, in the way that I'm coming from the outer reaches, and like you said, you're coming down to the East Village, and your people in your neighborhood are like, oh, well, you're being snotty, right? That there's this kind of you find your own romantic New York, even if you're from New York, right? Maybe we need to get someone here who grew up in the East Village. I mean, I don't know, like I have family, like my grandpa. And,
well, you know,
and I think it was different for them.
One of the people that I work with, we meet at her house in the East Village, and she's lived there for 17 years, and she had a similar kind of reaction, which was a feeling of the the neighborhood has become something different than it was, but she resists the romanticizing of the previous era because it was so bad. It was just like, oh, there's this weird kind of like, oh, New York was more pure when everyone was shooting heroin on the street. Yeah. And
right,
now,
but that's complicated. Because like you said, Carlos, like you have the conservative streak around the Just Say No because you saw things that said, well, yeah, this was like pure or whatever, romantic, but it's not romantic at all. It's really shitty. And you see people really hurt from it. And so there's
let me ask Carlos that because that's something that's come up on the podcast a lot, and certainly in the hipsters and gentrification episode. This idea, okay, let me just I'll just play devil's advocate and I'll play this character. I'm like the guy that says,
oh boy,
that says, you know, New York was what you had mentioned about that there was creativity during this era. This era wasn't just drugs and graffiti and crime, but there was something vital going on as well. And that vitality might have been in some way a reaction to the social situations that were surrounding people.
Yeah.
But okay, so the devil's advocate idea is like, is that all that stuff that thank God that era is over.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like I think that. There are people that say we're actually in a much worse situation now. Mm-hmm. That like that even though the situation with drugs and crime was bad in the 80s, the situation we have now is much worse because we have a city that's been taken over by banks and corporations, mm-hmm. and we've become a suburban city that even the small ethnic business owner has been pushed out by Chase Bank, mm-hmm. and Bed Bath and Beyond, everything else. And so the price we've paid for the elimination of crime has been too high, and we got this like corporate stale New York that's not vital at all. What do you think about that?
I'm conflicted about it. I'm totally conflicted about it because when I look back at my childhood, I think about it in ambivalent terms. There's times where I'm like, oh my God, how did I survive that? And there are other times that I pine for it, that I yearn for it. Have you ever seen the documentary, VH1's documentary, 1977, mm-hmm. The Coolest Year in Hell?
No.
It's narrated by people who
were in New York. Is this the like Studio 54 era? Yeah.
But also you get people of the South Bronx, the birth of hip hop, the Blackout, 1977, which mm-hmm. I remember clearly. And it's like, well, it was awful, but there was some beauty to it, and the fact that we survived it, those of us who survived that time, can romanticize it. So I'm ambivalent about that. Are these worse times now? In some ways, I feel that we're losing that New York, that we're losing some kind of authenticity.
Right.
But it's also a better life for a lot of kids growing up. The kids that I teach at LaGuardia, the hardest one of them, well, they're in college, so obviously they're a different group of kids, but even the hardest one of them, their hardest experience, it's not as bad as it was in the 70s and 80s.
And I appreciate that.
That as well.
I
would echo Carlos's ambivalence because there's a
It's the Times Square thing, right?
Because there's like it's really hard. It's mm-hmm. definitely really hard because yes, the price we pay is very hard, but at the same time, I don't want kids to suffer through the kind of stuff that you suffer, and lots of kids are still suffering through that, but I don't know what the perfect answer is, but
it's a really and I recognize because I've definitely been that person that's probably been like, oh well, you know, the edges were rougher, people did drugs and there was crime and gangs, but there was at least they didn't live in a Disney-fied corporate.
Yeah, but a lot of New Yorkers still don't.
Corporate.
Exactly.
Abused from the police position. At least I didn't live in that. But that's an easy thing for me to say as like the white guy from Ventura, California, that is just kind of diagnosing social problems in an intellectual vacuum. I mean, yes, I live in these cities. Yes, I live in New York. Yes, I ride the subway. Yes, I see a lot of inequality, but I haven't really experienced the shit edges of that economic stick. Like I really haven't. And so I recognize that it's kind of a fucked up position for me to be in to say, oh, well, it was better when
right.
things were worse. Because it was like, that, I wouldn't experience
but
that.
But a lot of right. New Yorkers say that, too. A lot of New Yorkers feel like, yeah. oh, it was better when it was worse. But I think exactly. that that's too easy so
it's
as
not
well.
Just, it's not that it was better. It's like, it got better, but the way it got better is kind of messed up.
Right. And that's fair, though. But, yeah. you know, the thing is that vision that you talk about, this Disney-fied thing, that, or, you know, the safe for the corporate, that doesn't exist all over New York.
True.
Right? Yeah. It doesn't exist in East New York. It doesn't exist in, I don't know, a lot. Like, you can name a whole bunch of neighborhoods throughout the boroughs where that doesn't exist. And the reality that you're talking about that we might romanticize actually still exists for a lot of people in a lot of pockets of New York in the way that it did for, you know,
and all
the
those
70s.
Luxury buildings being built. Think about it. It gives poor people something to look at to inspire them to work harder.
All right, I'm out. I got things to do.
I want to be in one of those luxury buildings.
That's the real trick of it, isn't it?
So Carlos, when the 90s happened and things, quote unquote, get better, how do you feel about it? I mean, you said you were a Giuliani voter, so you must have been.
Were you loving it?
That's what everyone's going to remember from this episode. It's like that motherfucker.
For the record, I did not vote for him the second time. Okay. I guess Ruth right. Messenger. That wasn't much of a choice there. Well, you know, I got treated to a couple of stops myself. So, yeah, you know, right. I voted for that policy and I
yes.
got it.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, you know, remember.
You got what you asked yeah. for.
I remember running one time from Blockbuster Video. This was like the late 90s. You still had videos with yes. the cartridges.
Yes.
And yep. it was raining and I had it inside my raincoat and I was running and these two guys in the car say, "Yo, stop." And I'm like, for a split second, I'm thinking these are just guys who want to mess with me.
Right.
But who's going to say, "Yo, stop," besides cops?
Yeah.
Right,
so
right, right.
My mind quickly reacted and I stopped. This was
Do you remember what movie it was?
No, I don't remember the movie.
Damn it.
I do remember it was a few weeks after the I'm going to do the Diallo case, the yeah. one who got yeah. shot 50
yep.
times.
Yep. Yes,
yes. So I was like, oh, shit, what do I do now?
Yes.
And so the guys got out of the car. And they were like
one of the guys that got shot 50 times?
Yeah.
One of the first.
Yeah, one of the first. Yeah, yeah. Right. One of the biggest cases.
Yep. Uh-huh, the Diallo case.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And the guys.
I knew about that one in California. It was a big case.
It was that big, yeah.
It was such a big story, uh-huh. yeah. And these guys came out, and they were like, "Yo, why are you running?" I'm like, "Because it's raining."
Cause it's raining.
And they point up to the sky. It's raining. He's like, "Oh, what do you got inside there?" It's like, "A video. You want me to check?" And they were like, "No, no, no." I was like, "Okay, well, you can come over." And they came and they took it out. So it was a video. And the guy goes, "Don't you feel lucky living in a neighborhood where the cops are so engaged and active?"
Oh my God.
And helping the people. And I was like,
I guess.
And he goes, "Better not say anything, right?" And I go, "Yeah." And I just laughed.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've had a few interactions with police and I've never felt lucky afterwards.
No, yeah, you never feel lucky, yes.
Yeah.
Lucky's not the term.
Lucky's not really the word that you're going to use. Yeah.
Whether you're a victim or a crime perpetrator, you're not.
You're, yeah. not you're not lucky
you're not
either
lucky
way.
At that point, yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that's, you know, because I think in the 90s was probably, right, so I graduated from high school in 93. I'm in college 93 to 98. Yeah, it took a long time. and sort of coming to some kind of political, social, sexual consciousness, right? Of
right.
like coming to some sort of radical state and like not really knowing and not really
understanding. Changes how you feel about New York, obviously.
Right, right. That's the thing. And like, you know, when I'm in high school in the early 90s and first taking these adventurous trips on this train by myself yeah. from my deep part of Brooklyn, not thinking about, you know, at that point, that like why the subways felt the way they did or they didn't feel or what the East Village looked like or didn't look like. And the fact that, you know, I think I've said this before, but going down to like around Tompkins Square Park and
yep.
had that change
yeah.
or had that not change, or Alphabet City, which is someplace I hung out a lot, though I guess not really past Avenue B, you know.
This was a dangerous time, but that was part of the appeal for you,
no,
right?
No, 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 exactly not.
No,
that's the thing
this
is by the 90s.
Oh, okay, this is
yeah,
Avenue B turning
by the,
into something else.
That's the thing
yeah.
is like by the 90s, I'm just going to like.
Because I
hadn't
heard about this Alphabet City and
no,
that was a place you didn't want
to
go.
Well, you didn't when I was a kid. And by the time I'm going by myself, I'm going to Benny's Burritos and I'm going
yeah.
to these little places
right.
and I'm hanging out. Mm. And it's not a question. And I never really thought about why that happened or what that meant. And then not until later where I thought about all these things and then became sort of really ambivalent about it of like, I don't know what I think about New York, right? Carlos, for those of you who don't read our emails, Carlos earlier emailed us the, you know, the video to LCD Sound Systems.
Yeah,
New
yeah,
York, I love you. I love you, but you're bringing me down.
Yeah. It's a great,
and I think it's really, it's so great, and it's perfect. It is the perfect condensation of
that ambivalence.
Yes,
so
yes,
well.
Yeah. Yes, of like what you feel, what New York makes you feel like, and this is from, you know, growing up here, and just before we pressed record, we were talking, Carlos and I, talking about, as New Yorkers, wanting to leave, right? Yeah. And whether we escaped New York or not.
Can
but then,
you really escape New York?
Right, right. And you know, here's the thing, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's part of you. Yeah.
So last summer, David and I got to spend, you know, 5 weeks outside of New York. And by week 2.5, we were both kind of...
I was ready for New York winter.
And like, you're like, I'll take January, man. Yeah. Get me out of here, right? And so it's...
I was like, I'm ready for a coat.
Scarves.
Yeah, going into like a bar at night and... Yeah,
it'll be really great, right?
It gets in you.
That's the thing, right? And then, you know, and I guess then from...
I keep mentioning bars. I'm like, is New York just made for alcoholics, maybe? That's what it is.
It's the perfect...
Oh, it's so great. You can drink anytime you want.
It's the perfect drinking city, as you said before. And it's the one thing whenever we consider moving to the West Coast is I get nervous about, well...
How are we going to drink?
How are we going to drink?
Yeah, because you have to drink and drive anywhere else.
Or somebody has to not drink.
Yeah.
Right.
And yeah, it actually is something that makes life unmanageable in many ways.
And it means that we can only have... So here's to come full circle. It goes back to house parties, right? Because this is what happens is that you can only have people over at your house because we're like, well, then we don't have to go anywhere. And so it's the kind of... I grew up in a neighborhood that was, it was called the two fare zone before the Metro card, where it was you paid for the bus and then you paid for the train. Yeah. And you paid for the train and you paid for the bus to come home. And it did feel like a big deal to go out and have the drinks and that's why people stayed local. It's why they stayed in their houses.
Because it's hard to get back.
Because it's hard to get back. Yeah. I remember when I moved out and one of my younger sisters had not, and I would said, "Oh, why don't you come hang out here? Come hang out here." And she'd be like, "Yeah, I really want to, but it's too hard.
It's difficult.
It's too difficult. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Washington Heights has a little bit of that because it's a train.
Oh yeah.
But it's a long...
And especially at night, there was always something going on.
Yeah, you know this,
made the train ride difficult.
Long.
always some track work or something.
Yeah, yeah. And just the trip is an epic trip. I can remember that first summer that you referred to, the party summer for me was, going up to Washington Heights from the West 4th train station, an A train, and being on a crowded platform, having to pee at 2 a.m, and knowing that I had at least an hour and 20 minutes of just sitting on the local train, because, I mean...
See, that gives me anxiety just thinking about it, right?
Like, that train is going to stop at West 4th. Yeah. It's going to stop at 14th Street.
At 23rd Street.
At 23rd, 28th, 34th, 42nd, and it's just going
to
go from there.
To 191.
Right, and I remember by the time it's like, stopping at 168, 175, I'm completely delirious. I mean, it's just like... for me, it was like there's only so many nights like that I could take.
Right.
Yeah. Before it got to the point where I think I'm just going to drink at home.
Yes.
You know, I don't think I need to go down there and experience the heterotopia of the village and the fantasy space. I think I'll have my fantasy space staring at the wall.
In my living room.
Or maybe popping out a lawn chair in front of the bodega.
And so and it's great. It's so funny how that shifts because we live, you know, we're in Sunset Park. We are 6 minutes away from the train station where there's no bus, and we, you know, for those of us who know us, this is why we throw dinner parties, because the circle gets even smaller where I'm like, oh, I'm not getting on the subway on the weekend. Yes. And we're relatively close to all kinds of things.
Yeah.
No, everyone who knows us knows you have to come here, or we don't do that on the weekend.
Did you ever go to Coogan's when you were in Washington Heights? It's the only drinking bar in all of Washington Heights. Or it was, I mean, I think some other
is that 175th?
No, 168.
168. There were bars up there that we went to. I don't even know if they're still there. There was almost like a little hipster bar, but there's an Irish bar. Oh, I wish I could remember the name of it, at 175th Street by the George Washington bus terminal.
I think I know which one you're talking about.
It's an Irish pub that looks like the kind of place that you just automatically get stabbed in as soon as you go in. I never had the courage to go in there, but I have a student that sometimes I have students that ask me to go have drinks with them, and they said, "Do you want to meet me at that bar?" And I was like, "Are you kidding? Do I want to get stabbed at that bar? Is that what you're asking me?"
Well, clearly he's not getting stabbed every time he goes.
Yeah,
fine.
Yeah. No, it's racist against the Irish to say that.
I know the bar you're talking about, and I never felt comfortable going in because I was Hispanic.
Well,
you know?
People smoke in there too. Like to this day, like I could smoke, that's what kind of made me really scared. Is that I walked by and I saw people smoking. I'm like, if they have no respect
that's
for the
hardcore.
Smoking law,
my God, that's hardcore.
What else? God knows what's going on in there.
Like those people are smoking.
They're probably not changing the ice every half hour the way they're supposed to, and everything else. So.
And the whole thing with the bathroom, that experience of the bathroom that you said, you know, you're waiting in the platform in the summer.
Yes.
And you have to go to the bathroom, and then the air conditioner, you appreciate it, but it makes things worse.
Yes.
You can do a whole podcast on just like the cruelty of lack of public bathrooms in New York City.
I agree.
Absolutely.
It is cruel.
Yes. It is. Yes. It is, because you can get tickets. Well, for gentlemen, you can get tickets, and the tickets that you get for public urination, because there's no place to go, is always a desk appearance. So that you have to say in public.
Know, there's a story right now. I think it was Crown Heights or Bed-Stuy. Hipster kids, they're gay kids. They got beat up by the NYPD just the other night.
Right.
And the NYPD initially approached them
because of
public
urination.
Okay.
Whoa.
And they were going to write them a ticket, and then you know the NYPD called them faggots and beat them up and everything. There's a video of it, and we can all.
Can
all get on YouTube and watch that later.
We should not.
To serve and protect.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about a lot of different angles of New York City. I think that we've come to the hard conclusion that we're all ambivalent about the changes that have taken place in New York City, right?
Because I think you said sometime just before about New York as a living entity.
Yeah, right. And you guys having been here your entire lives, as opposed to me being here the last 10 years, you guys, I think you've seen that entity,
just,
you know it more.
Just
it's
a
more,
little bit longer.
You know it more intimately, you've seen its face.
Yeah, but I think that, I think that only makes it even just more complex, the kind of like, the sort of, I don't know what I feel about
you
it.
You love it and you hate it.
Like, yeah, all at the same time. And David, you said that before, that it's like the very things that you hate are the things that you love, and the things that you love are the things that you hate, right?
And the things that I've seen that are like awful, like homeless people in like really dire situations and things that disturbed me late at night, all those things, New York wouldn't be New York without those things. That when I talk about like junior high school being the cauldron, New York City was definitely a cauldron for me. It sounds like it was for you guys too.
Yeah.
But maybe a slower moving cauldron of your whole life that like forged your identity and made you who you are. And that's a really important thing to recognize, I think, is that New York City is a place as ambivalent as we are about it. I think all of us recognize how powerful it is. It's like a potent place to grow up.
It is, definitely. It is. It marks you. Yeah, marks you for life.
It does. It does. I know this this poet who's a much older woman now, who's lived in San Francisco in the Bay Area for the last 35 years or 40 years. Oh God, it's at least 40 years.
Uh huh.
And I saw her in New York a few years ago. She's still a New Yorker. Like, there is just, she's from Brooklyn. She's from Cal Garden.
She's lived in San Francisco for 40 years.
40 years, she's still a
New Yorker.
Yeah, it marks you. It marks you.
A bit neurotic.
A bit angry. A bit belligerent.
It's funny you say that anger is because, I had mentioned this you know, this Rick Burns documentary and where it was talking about how all the immigrants, when they came to New York and they all went to the edge of the boat to look at the Statue of Liberty and have such awe of all the fantastic sights that and opportunities that awaited them in New York. I was that immigrant in a sense, coming to New York. I thought, God, this is the best place in the world. But it took me 10 years to build the hate part of the love hate.
The anger part of it.
That New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down. The idea of love hate existing simultaneously.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely took me a while to build up. I'm definitely, I think anyone that knows me knows that, you know, I can hate New York with the best of them and really
more than
feel,
me sometimes
and really come home and have actually such a misanthropic attitude towards everything I see in the people it's often at the exact same time, and I've heard other people say this idea of like, I have such I'll see things on the street and see people and have such empathy for them and be so in awe of, like, wow, isn't it amazing? Like, almost like I'm watching like Kayana Scotsi. It's like, look at how the humanity moves and look at what New York is. At the very same moment, I'm like, fuck these people. I hate them. And what kind of monsters would live here? Like, who would choose to be here of all places?
Right, so when your parents come and visit and say, I don't understand how people can raise children, that's the moment you're like, I know, I don't know.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Carlos, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah,
it was a pleasure.
This is great. I hope to talk to you again.
Thank you.